This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Kevin Rumley will tell you he had a happy childhood, like a 1950s Disney movie, he says. But as a teen, the happy life was shattered by the sudden death of his mom. Kevin felt the need for structure, so he signed up for the Marines. But his time in the service was cut short by an IED in Iraq. Kevin survived, but it took more than 30 surgeries and about a year and a half in a hospital to get him back on his feet. By that time, he was addicted to opioids. His future looked grim. Kevin did manage to piece his life back together with a little help from family, friends, and his skills as a drummer. Today, he's a Purple Heart recipient and the coordinator for the Buncombe County Veterans Treatment Court. That's a program that focuses on recovery for veterans rather than punishment if they have been convicted of a crime. Kevin Rumley is with us now. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
Talk about those early years in Fairfax, Virginia. Your time playing music, skateboarding. Talk about those early years.
Yeah, it's definitely the idyllic childhood. My parents were really supportive of every one of our endeavors. So I remember skateboarding at a young age, and my dad built us a half pipe. You know, it was kind of just the wooden ones with nails sticking out, but it was still just a fun neighborhood to grow up in. All the kids would come down to our house. And once we started getting into music, then they even soundproofed our room with these moving pads. So, yeah, my parents were really supportive of whatever we could get into.
That's really great. And it sounds like they put a lot of energy into it. I mean, your dad building a half pipe, mom and dad getting the soundproofing for your studio, because you're a drummer. Of course, I understand that if you're going to drum, I would soundproof your room too. But, but I mean, that's a lot of activity and action for parents, right?
Yeah, they put up with a lot. It was three boys. So, yeah, it was kind of a rough house, if you will.
Yeah, and so you're doing all that. And what about your aspirations at that time? I mean, you're skateboarding, you're drumming. Were you thinking about a career in music?
I don't think I was thinking about anything in the future at all. That was just kind of my childhood. It was really just having fun. You know, I never really excelled at school, but, you know, during recess, I was great at that. I was great at skateboarding after school.
Yeah.
So nothing in my future plans were really, you know, forefront.
It seemed like very happy. Everybody's very supportive. But also at a certain point, even then, I'm told that you did notice that you were anxious, right?
Yes. At a early age, I definitely was an anxious child. And I don't think that I knew how to identify that, but I was very shy and reserved. So a lot of kind of how I engaged with the world was through my older brother. He was 2 years older, and he started playing music, and I would just kind of hang out with him and his friends, but I would just be quiet in the corner watching him, you know, socialize and stuff. But yeah, I was always pretty anxious as a child.
I am told that at a certain point you realized that your future would either be as a park ranger or a monk. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I think those two career options came to me because they're both isolated experiences.
Yeah. But again, it's going well. And your dad had been a Marine, right?
That's correct. He was a Marine for 4 years, and then he was an officer in Northern Virginia for 20-plus years.
All right. So all this is going on, and then you're a teenager, and your mother dies suddenly. Tell us about that.
Yeah, she was the rock in the family. She kept us together and was that unconditional love and support that a mother provides. And I was in high school. My older brother was at college. And we got called to the principal's office, and we were told that our mother had gone to the hospital. So we got in the car, not really knowing what that meant. And I remember driving over, my neighbor picked me up and picked my little brother up too. And we're driving over, and she's not saying anything. So our anxiety is kind of going up, just thinking of all the what ifs. What if this? What if that? And when we pulled up to the hospital, I remember a sea of people kind of parting way as we walked through. and a social worker approached us and introduced herself and said that she was there for all the support that we needed, but we still hadn't been told the status of her mother. And then she took us back where I met my father and my older brother, and they were both crying. And so I think that was when we realized that she had passed. So they took us back into a room, and I got to see her there. She ended up passing away from a pulmonary embolism. Mm. It was unexpected. She was really healthy, and just one day unexpectedly did pass away. And so it felt like this veil had been lifted. My sense of security and safety was shattered at that single moment.
Difficult for all of you, and particularly difficult for your dad, and it changed things for him, did it not?
It did, and my mother and father, they started dating, I think, in eighth grade. They're both from Michigan, and my father's upbringing was unstable, but when he met my mom and my mother's family, he always called them his family. So he married the love of his life, and that was all he knew. And so I think for all of us, just our reality would never be the same. And I think for my dad especially, he wasn't prepared to handle having three young boys to raise. And I remember him telling me he didn't even know how to write a check, because he did the work and my mom managed the checkbooks back then, and, you know, just basic things that he was terrified of.
I'm talking to Kevin Rumley today on The State of Things. Kevin is in Buncombe County, he's a coordinator for Veterans Treatment Corps, a Purple Heart recipient and a veteran, of course, himself. Did your father's behavior change after that?
Yes, I think all of our behavior changed. My father definitely coped through drinking, and I know that his father also coped through drinking. And so as I was 16 years old and I was introduced to alcohol too, and I found that was my only place of solace and peace. So as just a young kid, I started drinking to cope, and some tensions grew in the house, and it was really us doing the best we could to survive. That's, as I look back now with more compassion and understanding for what we were all going through, we were doing the best we could with what we had, and for sure alcohol was what we had identified at that moment as just giving us that comfort and love.
It did that, but as you say, it created even more tension in the house. It led you basically out of the house, right? You were couch surfing in your later years in high school.
Yeah, I was couch surfing and just anywhere that I could crash. I have a really close set of friends that kind of supported me through that, and music was kind of this underlying theme throughout all of it. So even though is chaos at the house, I can go to my friend Alex's house or Tim's house and play drums and just not have to think about kind of the trauma at the household. So I always had that escape.
And one of the things your mom instilled in you, your dad too, of course, is military service, and your mom was civic service, and you became very involved in all kinds of things, including the Special Olympics, and you stayed involved even in this turbulent period, right?
Yeah, that's right, Frank. I was really, really blessed. My mother encouraged me to get involved in the Special Olympics at a very young age, and I just took a liking to it. I found a strong connection with the athletes, and I started coaching swimming, and then basketball, and then bocce ball. So even, in the turbulent times, my 16 and 17 and 18, before I enlisted in the Marine Corps, there was that constant of music and the constant of volunteering with the Special Olympics. And even if it was just Sunday mornings at the pool, and, you know, I at 16 years old would be hungover, but jumping into that pool, it was cold and I didn't want to, but I had 20 athletes that were looking up to me. So it was just enough to kind of keep me on track and really stay alive.
One of those good friends who was helping you get through it was Bobby, who became a good friend. Tell us about Bobby.
Yeah, Bobby is basically a surrogate brother, but he's an individual with Down syndrome, and he has since passed away, unfortunately, but he would just come up to me. He wouldn't speak or say anything, but he would just grab my hand or hug me. And his mother came over to me after one of the practices and said that Bobby, he's really shy and has a hard time making friends, and he's has a lot of anxiety. And I was thinking, well, I do too. This is great. And we just hit it off then. And after that, I would just hang out with Bobby and see him twice a week. We might walk the mall together or go out in nature. And he was a man of few words, but he loved to just hang out with me. And he would just say, Kevin, my best friend. And I knew that he was in a good mood, and it was impossible not to just feel happy myself.
You did make it through high school. We talked about the difficulties you had, the sudden death of your mother when you were a teen, your father left with three boys to raise, very difficult on all of you. You turned to alcohol, difficult for the family, not spending as much time at home. How did you make it through high school?
I think I made it through high school because of my close friend network and some supportive school social workers. They really encouraged me just to show up, even if I wasn't able to focus, if I wasn't able to do my homework or whatever state I was in. It was really my friends and the social workers at Fairfax High School that just encouraged me to keep going. So if it wasn't for them, I definitely wouldn't have graduated, and I'm not sure I would have made it to the Marine Corps.
You did graduate, and you did make it to the Marine Corps. Talk about your enlistment and what you were even meeting with that recruiting officer.
Yeah, I knew, I think, around 16 years of age that I needed something new in my life. I needed structure, and I had decided it was the Marine Corps. I still felt that kind of filial responsibility and dedication to service, and I really looked up to my father as a Marine. And I think I was 17 years old, and I grabbed my skateboard and ended up just skating down there. I had long blonde bleached hair, and I went to the recruiter's office, and I told him right then and there that I wanted to sign up to be a Marine, and I wanted to be a rifleman. And this is Northern Virginia, where you know, there's a lot of individuals that work for the Pentagon and the armed services here. And I remember the recruiter saying, you know, we got a lot of options. You don't have to be a rifleman. You can do other things. I said, nope, I want to do that job right there. And he said, easy enough, we can do that for you. So yeah, I was kind of naive. And I think a couple months later, the recruiter came over to my house. I sat down with my dad, and the recruiter was wearing his dress blues. He had the shiny medals on and just a beautiful uniform. I said, yeah, I made the right decision. Mm. And he started talking about boot camp as the 13 weeks of grueling exercise, and you'll be, you know, tested in mind and body and spirit. And I was really excited. So because I was 17, my dad had to sign for me, and he was really proud. And a month after graduation from high school, I was sent to Paris Island.
You did some prep, though. You heard all that about the grueling boot camp, and I think your father probably added his two cents when that conversation came up. You decided to get ready for that, right?
Yes, my dad told me that boot camp, it was all a game, and that the drill instructors and everyone around you that's yelling and you know, they're in this game too, and everyone's trying to achieve a certain ends, be it you know, your scores on the PT or the range, and everyone's really qualifying. But you have to be in the best physical shape of your life. So I took that really serious. I started training. I was swimming every day. I was running 5+ miles a day. And actually, where I'm recording from right now, Frank, is at the WAMU station, and it's connected to Sprout Run, which is this 10-mile run which goes from Arlington into DC across the Potomac, and it's gorgeous. And I used to train on that, and I remember just proudly wearing my Marine Corps shirt, knowing I was going to go to boot camp, and I got to be in the best shape of my life.
Well, I know that run you're talking about, and it is up and down and up and then up and then up some more, and I don't even remember the downs. So, and I'm sure I didn't get as far as you did. So you're ready to go, and you get there. So what was it like for you then?
Well, it's definitely terrifying. You get off of the bus. They purposefully, in Parris Island, drive you around in circles. It's in the middle of the night, and you drive for about an hour on this base, but you can't see anything. You don't recognize where you are, and they do that to disorient you. And then the bus lands, and five drill instructors just come on barking, telling you to jump off the bus and get onto these yellow footprints. And these are the famed yellow footprints that I'm seen in the movies and had learned about. And you're standing there, but you still have your long blonde hair, and everyone has all these, you know, identifying features. And then it all begins. They cut your hair off, and they issue your camis. And day one, you are not a person anymore. I wasn't Kevin Rumley. I was a recruit. And the whole point is to break you down, and they're really good at that. I give the Marines credit. They are good at breaking you down and building you up as a fighting machine, really.
Well, talk about that, because everybody told you, or at least your dad said, look, this is a game. Here's how you play the game. But the fact is, it's a pretty rough game. Did knowing that, I mean, how did that change things for you, or did it?
Well, I think it really helped me, knowing that it was a game. And my dad always said, you don't want to be the first. You don't want to be the last. You want to go undetected in boot camp. Mm. And I really took that to heart and just made sure, even if I was sprinting the fastest on our PT, that just at the end I might make sure another Marine is just there first. And sure enough, that helped me get through. They didn't know my name. And at the end, at graduation, I was invited to carry the Marine Corps banner. Mm-hmm. So you do kind of this celebratory 3-mile-long run. And as you go across different parts of Parris Island, you ring this massive bell. And it lets all the other recruits who are there at week one, I mean, it's kind of depressing when you hear that bell ring, because you know what? Those are Marines that are graduating and leaving this island, and week one recruits are just starting. Mm-hmm. So I was really honored to carry that Marine Corps flag.
You get through boot camp, but have you at this point processed the fact, because this is now, are we in 2003 we're talking about?
Yes.
2003, we're at war. Had you processed the fact that you were next up for that war?
Well, this seems to be a theme throughout my early life, is I'm not really processing the future and the implications of my decisions. I remember in boot camp, the drill instructor was telling us that we are at war, and that the Marines to your left and to your right, amongst them, at least one of them is going to be killed in combat. And I just interpreted that as another war game, just part of this training to terrify the young recruits and really just, you know, help us to focus on our training at hand. So no, it didn't dawn on me that I might be sent as an infantry 0311, which is the military occupancy. I was an 0311 rifleman, which means you are going to combat, but it still didn't dawn on me. I was just excited to survive boot camp, really.
Well, you were deployed first to Kuwait, later to Iraq near the Syrian border. What were you doing?
I was attached with 3-7 Lima Company, so even though I was an East Coast Marine, myself and a handful of others, we were sent to 29 Palms, California, and that's the largest Marine Corps base in the world, largely because it's mostly desert and sand. And we were going to be attached on the Syrian border of Iraq. We were charged with training the Iraqi forces, and also ensuring that the kind of arms that were crossing the border were stopped, because I think Huseiba, where I ended up being deployed, that was the small outpost. It was neglected by Saddam. They didn't have running water, and they managed, though, coming in from Syria. This is where all of the small arms were crossing and the IED materials. So it was about 100 of us that were sent to the Syrian border. I was with a force recon unit and a sniper unit.
You said going into this, and maybe a theme throughout your early life is sort of not being able to process the now with regard in the context of the future. You're there now. You're in combat duty. What did that do for you when you realized this is it? This is live fire.
Yeah, the reality that I had created for myself was shattered again. We were flying in on the helicopter, and I remember the door gunner started unloading on the 50 cal, and we were thinking, well, this is the closest we'll probably come to combat, because the Marines I was with had just done a previous tour in Iraq, and they didn't fire a single shot, and they didn't have to wear their flak jackets, the protective armor. It was actually a peaceful tour. So I kind of was thinking the same. Hey, we're going to go here, probably do some humanitarian aid, and then come back. And the minute we're flying in on the helicopter, we start unloading on the 50 cal. That was a shock to the system. And then we land, and within 30 minutes, an IED, an improvised explosive device, explodes right in front of me, but it was buried too deep. And it ends up catapulting the Marine like a slingshot through the air, and the earth rises up. But he was okay, and we were all okay, and it was, as a 19-year-old, it was, whoa, we are thrown into combat. This is everything that we train for, and your brain just clicks into that mode, and you're ready to go.
Another IED went off, and you were not so lucky. Walk us through that, if you will.
Yeah, we ended up, we had daily IEDs going off while we were there. And small arms fire, and we ended up, in total, we lost 26 Marines on the Syrian border. And on April 7th, I was on a foot patrol, and our lieutenant at the time was kind of leading, and we were handing out flyers, pushing for this new initiative that we wanted greater communication, and it was difficult. And as we're handing out these papers on Market Street, and it's just littered with activity, an IED goes off. And but I was in the back, and I wasn't hit. But I remember seeing our lieutenant. He was running back to kind of command station, and he had a log sticking out of his neck. And he was holding it there, and I was thinking, wow, that looks wild. He has a log lodged into his neck. Somehow it got there. And anyways, we were split in two because of this explosion. And so myself and a handful of other Marines had to divert around the cemetery. And as we're kind of going around, I'm just thinking to myself, wow, he had a log in his neck. And I'm turning around, and then boom, I black out. And an IED had gone off again. And it ended up tearing through my best friend Chris Wasser's body. And he passed away instantly. And another Marine, PFC Vega, he was injured. He lost several toes and fingers. And the remaining shrapnel went through my legs and my arms and my hands, and shrapnel in my eye. It was just a terrifying, overwhelming experience.
You mentioned at least two of the Marines that you lost that day, and then what happened to you, the shrapnel going through you. In that moment, how much of that did you know?
Well, in that moment, not a lot. In this specific explosion, Christopher Wasser passed away. I should say that PFC Vega did survive after a lot of rehabilitation, but I was terrified. I can only describe it. That a sense, I had really hoped of perhaps a sense of serenity or peace coming over me at my time of death, but it was a feeling of drowning and a feeling of complete terror as I would look down and see my femur bones and my bicep and my skin and flesh has just been removed. And I am unable to get up or move any of my limbs. And I'm pretty sure that I'm going to die on the sands of Huseba. But I had the corpsman, Doc Matthews. He came over to me and he shot me up with morphine twice. And I should tell you, Frank, there's a book that kind of highlights my experience and the Marines I was with, our journey. It's called Blood Stripes. And my friend Chris Wasser's mother, she sent me the book and said, "Hey, Kevin, you're in this book. You even have a line." And I was really excited. So I look through this book and I find my one line and I'm going through and I read it. And it tells about how Doc Matthews gave Lance Corporal Rumley a shot of morphine and he became downright chipper. So I'm told that my mood was lifted from a state of terror to being downright chipper. And then my one line for posterity is, "Sergeant, is my private still there?" So that's for the history books, Frank.
I'm talking to Kevin Rumley today on The State of Things. Kevin is a Purple Heart veteran, and he is the coordinator of the Buncombe County Veterans Treatment Court. We'll talk more about that. Do you you read that in the book. Do you actually remember saying that?
I don't remember saying that.
But there you are. So in this moment, after the shot of morphine, you may or may not have let off that line. But now it is going to be, and in fact, that was intact. You're fine, but the rest of you is not. And it is going to take you a long time. You're 18 months in the hospital, are you?
Yes, 18 months, 32 surgeries. And I remember the doctor saying that I would never walk again. So it was pretty disheartening in the beginning.
Talk about that. I mean, there, what did you say, 32 surgeries, right? 18 months. Are you thinking at the time, I suspect that when you get that initial prognosis, you're pretty much believing them, or are you pushing against that, saying, "No, doc, you're wrong. I'm going to walk"?
Well, I think here could be a time where not really thinking about the future again paid off for me, because he may have said that, but that was down the road, and all I cared about was in this moment learning how to maybe use my pointer finger or my thumb again. And being able to lift my leg or get a couple more degrees of motion out of my left leg. And so, yeah, I don't think at all I took that to heart. If anything, my Marine mentality kicked in and said, "I don't think so, doc. I'm going to do this my way."
Were things, what about as time progressed with each successive surgery, with each passing month, what is your frame of mind? How are you thinking about, or are you at all thinking about your future?
I was really fortunate because I was at Walter Reed Hospital in D.C., and growing up in Northern Virginia in Fairfax, I was really close to my friends and family, whereas a lot of the other Marines that were in the hospital may have been from the West Coast or Colorado, and it was really hard to get their families in, so they may only see them for a week-long trip, and then the family had to return. I had friends that would visit me every single morning. When I was getting my first surgeries, and they were really, really intense, and they were clearing all the shrapnel still out of my body, and I had early flashbacks that would wake me up every single morning at 4:30 a.m., and they were terrifying, and I would wake up screaming, sweating, thinking that I still needed, that I was still over there, and I had a friend, Tim Scholl, who every day he would arrive at 4:30, he would drive in from Northern Virginia, and just so as I woke up reliably with this flashback, he would be right there, and you know, just to calm me down. And he's just, I think, a reason that I was able to make it through these difficult times. Him and my other friends and my brothers, they got me through it.
Got you through it, and now you are the coordinator for the Buncombe County Veterans Treatment Court. We'll talk about how we got you out of that hospital and into Buncombe County. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Kevin Rumley today. He helps combat veterans get their lives back on track, and it's a need that he knows all too well. He was on tour in Iraq when an IED went off nearby. He was told he would never walk again. After more than 30 surgeries and a battle with opioid addiction, Kevin did get back on his feet. It took a lot of help from his family, friends, and music. Kevin started a band with his older brother called Her Marigold. Here's a little sample of that, a song called Obedience Freely. Is a clip from my guest Kevin Rumley's music. He's also the coordinator for the Buncombe County Veterans Treatment Court, a program that focuses on recovery for veterans rather than punishment. He is a recipient of a Purple Heart. Kevin, we talked about your stay in the hospital, and you realized that you had become addicted to opioids as well.
Yes, I think it's pretty common for the veterans that go through extensive physical trauma to be given the opioids. And at my discharge from Walter Reed, I remember having a bag full of opioids, but I always say I didn't have a plan and I didn't have any hope.
You get out. What happens next? Because you went home and the first thing you did was live with your dad and hadn't seen him in a while. How did that all work out?
I think it was definitely difficult going back to my father's, just because I kind of entered into that old role again of just being, the 16-year-old troublemaker. I had gone through the Marine Corps, but it was such a wild experience, and it had all happened in 2 years. And for my dad, looking back, I have the compassion to understand he had almost lost his son, and so he's not wanting to be too strict and overbearing, but I was just without structure and addicted to opioids. So as much as my dad did want to support me and really give me kind of a routine and help me back on my feet, I wasn't in any place to receive that direction. And so once again, I kind of slipped back into the old patterns of coping, not just with the physical pain, which was chronic, but the emotional pain. And I'm living in the same house where I lost my mother when I was 16, and so all of that trauma is coming back. But throughout all of this, opioids, they gave me this sense of peace and euphoria, and that was all that I could really handle at that time.
Eventually, you found yourself back living with some old bandmates from high school, right?
That's correct, and we started playing music again. It was special, even when I was at Walter Reed Hospital. They would give me a weekend furlough or a break because I lived in Northern Virginia. And my friends, one time, they picked me up. And I knew they were planning something because there were a lot of friends. And they took me to my buddy's house. And at the time, I was in a wheelchair. And they wheeled me into the house. And they had surprised me by setting up my drum set. And I remember they carted me behind the drum set. And I have these five cymbals and this beautiful golden birch drum set. And I hadn't held a drumstick in 2 years, but it all came flooding back. And I remember playing those drums and hearing the toms and the bass drum. And that was the sense of hope that I needed. So, yeah, I was able to reconnect with my friends, start playing music. And ultimately, we moved to Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah, you did get into a treatment because it, on the one hand, it gave you a sense of hope and maybe a little sharper picture of a future, but it didn't solve the addiction problem. So you had to go through a treatment plan, right?
That's correct. Yeah, as healing as music is and as powerful as my friends had been in my life, addiction is just more powerful. And as I've come to learn, it's a chronic disease that we need to to manage. And there are many pathways to recovery. I was fortunate to have my older brother, Matt, living in Asheville, and he had seen me struggle through the years. He had seen me cross all these lines that I had drawn in the sand, that I would never do heroin or that I would never cross this or that line. And I just found myself there. And he was so incredible because he never told me what I needed to do. He always unconditionally supported me and helped me identify what I wanted, what were my values and my goals. And so finally, he did. He took me to the VA hospital in Asheville, the Charles George, and I was able to detox from opioids, and they placed me on what's called medication-assisted therapy, and I was put on Suboxone.
And that really helped you? That was helpful.
Yes, it saved my life, definitely. And I'm a big advocate now for medication-assisted therapy for individuals suffering from opioid addiction. It's just a pill that you take every day, and it manages the physiological craving for the opioids, but you don't receive any high or euphoria. It just binds, and it freed me from the addiction, and I can't speak highly enough of it.
Once you get that under control, then you can start dealing with those underlying issues, which you did, and you went to UNCA, right, and graduated with a degree in public health eventually, right?
Eventually, yeah. School was never my forte, but I did graduate from UNCA in public health, and I had a blast there. It was such an incredible faculty and supportive staff. They really encouraged me to go out and pursue my passions, and I found that I really like working one-on-one in the community. Systems level is great, but there's just something about working with the community members towards an identified goal. So,
why was your goal public health?
That's a good question. I think it was, again, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my future. And I had a professor early on, Dr. Batata, and I think I was interested in the work she was doing with social justice and addressing inequality in the community and all of its different forms. So, yeah, I was just drawn to certain professors, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, you didn't know what you were going to do, so you go into a cash-starved, publicly mistreated area of public service, totally neglected and vitally needed, and that's you. There you are, working your way out of addiction. You do that, you graduate, and tell us about graduation day from UNCA. A little bit of a surprise in store for you, eh?
Oh, it was a surprise. I'm sitting with the rest of the cohort, and the provost is describing this award called the William and Ida Friday Award, and she starts talking about the recipient and is naming these things that sound a lot like my story, and it still didn't dawn on me until they said my name, Kevin Rumley, to please come up, and I walk up on stage, and they give me this plaque. And it had been an award, I guess, where you needed 10-plus faculty members to write these letters of recommendation, and it was for community service. So it was really a great honor, and I was also excited because I got to sit next to this great musician who was receiving his honorary doctorate, Warren Haynes, so... Yeah, it was just a blast on graduation day.
So that was the William and Ida Friday Award for Community Service. After undergrad, then you go to Western Carolina University for a master's in social work, and that's when you started working for the Buncombe County Veterans Treatment Court, right?
That's correct. And I was working at NC Brookhaven Behavioral Health and going to school at WCU for my master's in social work, and I was introduced to the Veterans Court, this non-punitive diversion court for veterans with nonviolent felony charges. And so I just started by volunteering, and I was a mentor, just helping veterans through that process.
Tell us more about that process. Forgive me for interrupting this, but I do want to hear more about what the Veterans Court is all about.
Yeah, the Veterans Treatment Court of Buncombe County, it's a two-year program, and it has five phases. And so instead of sending a veteran to prison where nothing is addressed, we want to plead them into our court and really get to the core issues, the unaddressed suffering, the unaddressed trauma, addiction, and mental health issues that may have led them to the criminal justice system. So through the five phases, we connect them to treatment, we connect them with stable housing, vocational support, education, anything that can contribute to their well-being and a sense of purpose and hope again. And so it's a transformational journey, and we see a lot of the veterans, when they first plead into the court, they're at the same place that I was when I first got out of Walter Reed. They're suffering. But by the end of the 2 years, that transformation has taken place. They have a stable job. They're in school, working full time. And we see a lot of them find a great deal of identity through community service and volunteerism.
Yeah, and in many ways find themselves and, of course, recognize the error that they made, whatever got them in contact with the criminal justice system. Now, here you are working for this, and you find out later that essentially you are being groomed to head that organization, right?
Yeah, I didn't know that. At the time, I was just doing my internship in grad school under the direction of Dr. Eric Howard. So he was the program coordinator for Veterans Court and my supervisor. And so I was just going, doing my internship, learning from him. And only later did I learn that he was grooming me for the position. He had different plans in place. He was going to go to Asheville City Schools as the director of student services. And he was grooming me to be the new coordinator. And one day he just came in and said, "All right, I need you to apply for this job, Kevin, because it's yours, and I'm leaving in 3 weeks." And
wow.
So I applied,
well,
and fast forward.
I mean, did you apply? I mean, did you think, "Oh, yeah, I'm ready for this," or did you have to pause?
I definitely wasn't ready for it, but he had built a great ship, the Veterans Treatment Court. So I knew that if I just kept my hands on the wheel, there's an amazing team with probation. It's an interdisciplinary team of community members, the Charles George VA. I knew that I was going to do fine because of the staff that I worked with.
He built a great ship, but not everybody thought it should keep sailing. There were some political difficulties and funding challenges, right?
There were, and there's state-level challenges with funding because not every county has a VA hospital, and that's an integral part of the success of our program. And the argument was that if every county in North Carolina can't have a veterans court, then no county should. But under the direction of the Honorable Judge Pope, we have continued forward. We have county funding, so Buncombe County has been a great support. NC Brookhaven Behavioral Health has supported the Veterans Court even when the state funding ended. And I have to tip my hat to NC Brookhaven. The CEO is a Vietnam Purple Heart veteran, and he just believes in what we're doing. And so, yeah, he kept really the VTC afloat. And I'm happy to report, Frank, we were just awarded 4 years of funding through the Department of Justice.
Great stuff. Kevin Rumley is my guest today on The State of Things. He is a Purple Heart veteran and now the director of the Veterans Treatment Court, coordinator, I should say, in Buncombe County. You know, talk about the value of a program like this. I think I and anyone with a soul and a conscience could say that we are grateful that these programs exist for all the reasons you laid out, that people who get into trouble because of their trauma and stress, you know, need some kind of compassionate care and being able to be brought through a process and held accountable at the same time. You wonder if this shouldn't be more common to our criminal justice system in general, and we're grateful that it is for veterans, but shouldn't it be, or do you think it could be something that we could apply more generally to traumatized citizens who find themselves in the same trouble?
Definitely. I think this is the future of the criminal justice system. And in Buncombe County, we're fortunate to have a host of problem-solving courts. That's what they call them. And it is that compassionate, empathetic, understanding, treatment-based approach instead of the punishment that we're typically used to. And it works. We, right now, in the Veterans Treatment Court of our graduates, we have a 0% recidivism rate. Mm. So they're not reoffending, and they are working and contributing to the tax base and saving public dollars.
Just so you know, I think statewide, the recidivism rate, the last time I looked, was around 67%. So it's upwards of three quarters in nationally and statewide. So there's your comparison for you. You are doing well. Yours is the story we love to hear, albeit we'd rather not hear the painful parts. But if you had to go through that, it's good to hear that you came through. But I know that you are one who will tell us that you have to stay with this every single day. You don't reach this pinnacle and you know, sort of cross the finish line and say hurrah. Is this something you have to work on every day?
It is a daily practice. And if even for a minute you let your guard down and think that you've arrived, addiction and unaddressed trauma, it does reappear. And that's something I remind the veterans in the court every day, is it's not a destination, it's a journey. And recovery is really about a continuum of wellness. And I'm a big advocate for harm reduction interventions, needle exchange, and education, because kind of the antiquated ideology that you're either using or you're not using, we can't look at addiction that way anymore. There's emerging science and medicines that can help people with their recovery, and we need to explore them.
And you're on tour right now. The reason that you're at NPR Studios in Washington and not right in front of me here in Durham is because you're on tour with Tyler Ramsey, which is an Asheville-based rock band. East Coast tour. How's it going so far?
It's a blast. We are heading up to New York right now. We're going to play a couple shows there and then go to Richmond, Virginia, and then back to Asheville.
Good luck with the tour, and be happy to meet you in person next time we get a chance. Kevin Rumley, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thanks, Frank.
Kevin Rumley, Purple Heart recipient and the coordinator for the Buncombe County Veterans Treatment Court. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jenny Lawson ran the board today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.